Yeah, having my head shoved into the steps of the Ulster Bank in Ranelagh, cold butt of a gun put into the back of your skull. That's a moment where you go, okay, yeah, I think this one's up.
How does a high-flying academic become one of Ireland's most prolific bank robbers?
What I would see as the most important part of this still lies open.
I'm Not Here to Hurt You, a brand new series from the award-winning team behind the Indo Daily.
That November day, that's where it all begins.
Out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
On the latest episode of Real Health with me, Carl Henry, I'm delighted to be joined by international best-selling author Hemant Sunim, telling us what to do when things don't go your way.
When we are, you know, very young and have a first love, and the first love did not work out, we feel as though this is the end of the world. However, we learn that is not the case. We move on. We find some other people. So we begin to see that when things don't go your way, maybe it's not the end.
As ever, we're available on all podcast platforms.
A warning about today's podcast. It contains topics that some people may find distressing. Today on the Indo Daily, shot at 16, interned at 19, and dead at 64. GAA legend Philly McMahon on his inspiration, his dad, the concluding episode. Yesterday, we heard how Philly's dad's shooting by the British Army at the age of 16 had deeply shaped his life and almost took it.
I think there was a sniper on Divis Flats shooting down at the Brits, and then there was a volley of shots aimed down towards where he was with some friends. He got shot in the stomach. He looked down and his whole stomach was hanging out, and when he was touch and go, yeah.
Today we hear what life was like on the run and the risks that Philly and his dad took to return to Belfast on a regular basis.
You know, when we were young, like, I used to go up the north every second weekend, and he'd travel up with me. I'd have to call him Frank, who was my uncle.
Was his father ever able to live a normal life, knowing he was a wanted man?
You know, because ultimately he sacrificed, and all of his friends and comrades sacrificed his life, but also the things that we take for granted in our everyday life, he never had.
And while Philly's sporting career went from strength to strength, his personal life was tested.
It was a blow. I was going training, but like, I didn't want to be there. Just wanted to spend as much time as I could with him because I knew time was running out.
Can Philly accept that there were innocent people murdered by the Provisional IRA and that it can't all be written off against defending the community?
I certainly need to understand a lot more from both sides, to be honest. I would have obviously a bias towards my dad's history and his involvement.
And what next for the sporting hero? Could it be a move into politics?
I've been asked a lot. I've been asked to go for the next general election.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, we conclude our two-part special with Dubs legend and Irish Independent columnist Philly McMahon to look at how his life was shaped by events in Northern Ireland while he lived in Dublin's Ballymun. In the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of controversy about extradition, and we had a lot of anti-extradition marches in Dublin quite frequently. Did your father always feel that he was under threat, and was he always kind of waiting for the knock on the door and the guards to arrest him and extradite him back up the north?
Yeah, like, one of the big things we always had a discussion about was obviously the Good Friday Agreement, where the Republicans and the Loyalists that were imprisoned were... well, let go, and there was a pardon, let's say. He would have had friends post the Good Friday Agreement that would have been picked up and arrested. We never travelled abroad because of his passport, like, you know. We always wanted to go over to Scotland, and, you know, like, he was an Everton fan and a Celtic fan, so we always wanted to go over to watch Celtic, and I always, come on, we go over, especially when I was older, and especially when he was ill. I said, come on, we get over and watch a Celtic match, you know. And he just couldn't. He was at that age where it being habitually built into him to be paranoid about the travel side of things. But I suppose when I was very young, I didn't see any of that. You know, it was only when I got older and he got older, we were aware of how paranoid he was of it. When we were young, like, I used to go up the north every second weekend. And
now, who would you go up with?
With him.
With him. So despite being on the run from the north, he was still going up and down across the border. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He'd travel up with me. I'd have to call him Frank, who was my uncle. It was an incredible experience at a young age, travelling into certain parts through the train, and you see the British Army getting on and stuff like that. I would have been at a certain age that I would have realised his situation, and I would have, that would have been daunting.
Was he paranoid on a daily basis, or was it just about travel?
No, definitely not on a daily basis. Like, when he was at home in Dublin, in Ballymun, there was no issue. When he was going up the north, it was an issue when he was travelling, but not when he got up there, because he knew where to go. Like, you know, anywhere he was bringing me, he was welcomed with open arms anywhere he went, and it was incredible. Like, you know, any pub he'd go into, those days he'd kids in the pub and they'd all meet, all his friends would meet, and they'd celebrate him being up there, like, you know. But he'd only be there for a couple of hours and he had to be gone in case someone says, here, he's up here, get him, you know.
Somebody said, yeah.
They're special times to look back upon and say, you know, when people celebrate you arriving back into the community, you must have done something positive for the community, albeit maybe it being, in the grand scheme of things, societally, it's probably bad, but they would have felt this person coming back into our area as a hero, as someone that was brave, someone that supported us, and little things that the people used to do. They used to, like, give him a few bob. You know, he never had to put his hand in his pocket when he was up there. And, you know, because ultimately he sacrificed, and all of his friends and comrades sacrificed his life, but also the things that we take for granted in our everyday life, he never had. He couldn't have, to a certain extent, because, like, I mean, he just couldn't go and visit his mom. Like, you know, they have to be organised to, you know, to meet them somewhere, because especially early on, there would have been special branch watching to see,
surveillance would always be happening. And
what's happening? Where's his family? Most. Is he going to visit his family? All those things, you know. When he had family members that were ill, again, those little things that we just take for granted nowadays, he would have struggled to do that. And especially, let's look at it from an age point of view, he was still quite young. His life was directed completely for him after certain events.
Do you believe now that his life and his quality of life, it had an impact upon his health, and ultimately, did he effectively live in ill health all of that time because of the injuries he sustained, the actual acute challenges that must have in your mental health as well, in terms of being constantly watching your back? Was his health shaped then, do you believe, by events in Northern Ireland?
He was a father that at stages I was embarrassed about, in terms of getting up and dancing on a dance floor like every young kid is, because he loved dance music, right? So in his 60s, he was up dancing around with my mates, and my mates loved him for that. And I was like the typical, you know, son of going, oh, Dad, will you sit down and stop dancing? So he was a very young, in his own mind, he was very humorous, but he was also very active, and he wasn't very unhealthy in terms of his body shape, you know, his physical profile. But there's definitely, his mental health was impacted massively from the troubles, massively. Like, you know, struggled with depression a lot. He had no way of understanding how to deal with trauma from what he experienced. You're shot in the stomach at 16. You just put that, a kid from down south now. Imagine a kid now being shot in the stomach at 16. What psychological supports would he get? You know, he had none of that, because he couldn't avail of any of it, because he'd be known to authorities, you know. So he had to get on with that. He had to deal with that. The way he dealt with it, unfortunately, was depression, you know. So he would have fell into deep depression, and a couple of days later, he was fine, you know. He'd go to bed and he'd work hard, and that was his way. That was the old school way. And I'm, you know, a couple of other relatives that have struggled with the troubles over the years, and it's very similar pattern. Like, you know, there's a lot of support. Some people might argue that there's support up there now from the point of view of the troubles and the people that have experienced the troubles, but that doesn't travel down south, you know, for people that were on their own, and he would have struggled a lot with that.
Tell us about his cancer diagnosis.
He was struggling with his stomach, and he built up this complex with doctors, because every time he was going to doctors, they were like, okay, take a tablet for your nerves, take a tablet for you to sleep, struggled with sleeping. And he'd always, like, constantly ask for them. And a particular doctor would have got to a point where they're like, no, you're just kind of addicted to these kind of tablets that you need to take. And he's like, no, I actually need these. I'm in pain all the time. So he built up a bit of a complex with doctors. And one day he was in agony. He went into the hospital and he got blood tests done. And they said, look, we've done everything. We'll send you the blood tests back. He went back home. And then a couple of months later, he was really, really bad again. And we went to a different hospital with him. There was a nurse there, actually. And the nurse said, get this man morphine. He's in terrible pain. We need to do tests on him straight away. Got the tests and came back. You're terminally ill, stage 4, with cancer in the stomach. He was never going to be able to differentiate the normal pain, as I said, to this cancer now, you know. So we don't know how long he had the cancer, but obviously he had a good while for it to get to the stage of stage 4. Again, for me, my dad, in a way, didn't die of cancer. He obviously did die of cancer, but he died of poverty in many ways, because if my dad had private health insurance or he went privately in terms of scans and stuff like that, maybe, he would have been caught in time in terms of what stage he was at. Like, so you asked about his physical health and being shot had an impact. It definitely did, like, because all of those little pieces, all those little variables fed to the stage where he was terminally ill and he died.
And Dublin are still the champions. It's 6 in a row.
He passed away in 2018. You're at the absolute peak of your powers in terms of your GAA career. You're going for the historic 5 in a row. Goes on to become 6 in a row. You've won 8 All-Irelands.
Dublin, arguably the greatest football group ever to play this game. They made
How were you coping at that point? So on the one hand, in your sporting career, you were about to achieve something that no other team had done before. And then in your private life, you got your dad being ill, and you're probably aware he was going to die at that stage.
Mm. It was extremely difficult, to be honest. It was a blow. I was going training, but like I didn't want to be there. And I suppose I just wanted to spend as much time as I could with him, because I knew time was running out. I think he was given 6 months and he lasted 12 months. A few months into the diagnosis of him being terminally ill, there was a stage where he was fatiguing, and the family said, right, okay, maybe respite is a good option here. So he went in and he was there for a couple of days, and he was amazing from it. Like, St. Francis Hospice in Blanchardstown, they were, oh my God, they were unbelievable for him, because he came out of that. And we were all, second guessing, kind of going, what is going on here? Like, you know, his energy is unbelievable. He doesn't look like somebody that's going to pass anytime soon. I was playing football. I didn't want to be there. And it got to a stage where I had to kind of flip me thinking to, do you know what? Instead of thinking that way, think the more I'm there playing and the more I'm helping my team possibly get to, you know, the latter stages of the All-Ireland and possibly win it, the more energy I can give them. That was the motivation for me that year. It wasn't really to win an All-Ireland. It was more so to give him energy. That was another big learning from me in terms of my sporting career, that whether it was my first year or my last year, you know, when you play sport, when you put that jersey on, whatever county jersey that may be, you're lifting somebody. You know, you're giving someone, you know, these emotions that can help them another day. So 2017 was his last All-Ireland that he's seen, you know.
And he was in the stand that
he was
that,
there
that last year, yeah.
We bet Mayo in the All-Ireland final. And I remember, because he'd normally come down towards the end of the stand where the hoarding is. And he'd, because he's, you know, I would have seen him and people would have known him as a tough man, like, you know, with the adversity he went through, but very rarely would cry, you know. But he was bought every year we won, you'd see him down there crying his eyes out. So that was my chance to build up a little bit of army to slag him that he was crying, you know, that he's that type of traditional person, like that I could have the banter with him then after a few tears, you know. But that year I actually had to go up to him in the stand because he was too ill to come down. So I had to jump over the fence and go up the stairs to where he was sitting. And I'm sure those Mayo fans looking at me going, you know, I'll give him a few digs on the way up the stairs. But yeah, that was special. That was a special time. I think we got to the league final or the Leinster final of the following year was a realisation that, you know, this is it. Like, you know, because we brought him onto the pitch after, I don't know if it was the league final or Leinster final, but we brought him onto the pitch after the game. It was lovely. It was myself, my mum, my sister, My cousin was there with his wife, and we just walked around Croke Park. The stadium was empty, and at that stage we knew, right, okay, you know, this is the last time he'll get a chance to walk onto Croke Park. That must have been the league, and I think it was the Leinster final possibly where I played, and then I got a phone call after that. My mum said, oh, we had to go early. So he was walking in, he was starting to lose his balance a little bit, and he fell. And it was quite sunny that day as well, I think, so they were trying to keep him out of the sun, but he left at half time, you know. And at that stage, you know, when he was falling and stuff like that, then we knew he was getting weaker, you know.
You seem to be somebody who, on the one hand, you're achieving sporting greatness, and yet on the other hand, there's trauma in your life. And I suppose the same thing happened to you back at the beginning of Dublin's great run. So you win in 2011. You're replacing the great James McCarthy in that Billy McMahon is replacing the great James McCarthy. What a squad to have. Nobody else stood a chance. And then you're winning again in 2013. And your brother then passes away in 2012. And again, was it difficult for you to focus on sport when that's going on in your family?
When John passed away, I remember getting the phone call off. Like, my sister then gave me the message that John had passed, and I was doing personal training with a guy, and then I went, what's going on here? Like, you know. So I walked, got in the car, drove down towards Ballymun, and just at the M50 roundabout there in Ballymun, I actually went completely around the roundabout and back up. And then I went back into the gym, and your man was just kind of coming out. And he's like, is everything all right? Like, you just left. And I was like, yeah, everything's grand. And then I got another phone call, and I was like, no, this is not happening, like, you know. So I was in a total shock, like, you know. Got in the car, went down to the house. Everybody was in the house and inconsolable, as you can imagine. And I opened the door, seen everybody to the left, and I went, oh my God, I can't go in there. Went straight up the stairs, you know. So that was a different kind of experience to my dad, because my dad didn't die all of a sudden. There was a time frame, you know. So when John passed, we had to travel over to the UK to get him, to bring him back. He lived in London at the time. It was difficult at that stage because you were educated that if you had a friend or a family or somebody in a community that was someone that was struggling with drug addiction, with the stigma and shame, you treat them a certain way. And I always remember, you know, after big games or after games in general, family members of my teammates in the banquet or in the hotel, you know, and I'd always like, just love to bring my brother here, like, you know, I'd love them to experience this. And I suppose I always had this wrong education that, like, I'd be embarrassed if I brought my brother here, like, you know, which is bullshit in hindsight, like, you know. No family is perfect. No individual is perfect either. Like, so after his winning the All-Ireland in 2011, John had said, I'm going to come home for the 20. If you get to the All-Ireland final, we're in the All-Ireland semi-final at this stage. If you get to the All-Ireland final, I'm coming home. I says, right, grand. And as, if I'm being honest, I had one eye on kind of going, what kind of shape is he in? And on the other hand, I was like, I'd love him to be there. We got beaten in the semi-final. That was that in 2012 by Mayo. And then a few weeks later, on the 7th of September, a couple of days after my birthday, John passed away. So he died from a heart arrhythmia. He was about 4 or 5 days away from going into rehabilitation to come off methadone as well. So he'd wrote me a letter. He'd wrote me within my birthday card, and he'd said, look, this is it. I'm going to do it. I'm ready to change, come off methadone. He'd been off heroin. And my mum had been saying a few months prior to that, you know, she was going to bring him home. And I was like, if you bring him home, like, he's going to be around the same lads and he's going to take drugs again, and we're probably going to kill him because we're aiding his addiction. Again, in hindsight, it was our poor education on addiction. None of this means we were going to save John, but ultimately, if we had John within our grasp, let's say, of being able to travel to him or see his URI, or maybe being around him days prior to before he passed, we would have been able to maybe make an impact, but we didn't. And again, hindsight is great, but it didn't happen, and John passed away at the age of 31. Yeah.
politics? Any interest down the line?
I've been asked a lot. I've been asked to go for the next general election. I've been asked, you know, I've been asked to, previous years, I've been asked to get involved in different, and it just, for me, I'd like to think if I got into politics that I'd have more restraints to what I do socially. I'm only a small fish in the pond in terms of certain topics in society, but whatever I can do to make a difference, I will, you know. I hope there's big changes coming in terms of our drugs policy. I'm involved in the advisory group for the Citizens Assembly that's going on at the minute, so I'm hoping that we'll see big change there, because that's going to have a huge impact societally in Ireland. For me, the crucial part is when you leave this planet, what do you leave behind you? And not even so much from a legacy point of view, but also from the energy you've given people, what you've done. If you've got the opportunity to do that, take it, you know. So John gave me that opportunity with a purpose when he passed. And that's the most, for me, again, in my opinion, it's the most powerful thing you can have.
By the way, which party?
Oh, I can't tell you that. But I was privileged to be asked, and I wouldn't be disrespectful by saying them.
That's fine. You're very much somebody who is shaped by your community, your background, your own family experience. And your view of the Troubles is obviously through the prism of your dad and your dad's experience. Do you accept the other side of the argument about the Troubles, though, and the Provisional IRA campaign, that there was a lot of murder, there was a lot of atrocities, there was a lot of killings? I just noticed at the weekend, Colin Parry, his son, Tim, was killed 30 years ago this year in a bomb in Warrington outside Liverpool. He was only a few years older than you. Another boy was killed that day, was only 3, Jonathan Ball, again, only a couple of years younger than you. It was the day before Mother's Day. Inexplicable why that tragedy happened. Do you accept that there was innocent people murdered by the Provisional IRA, and that it can't all be written off against defending the community? Or what's your take on it?
I certainly need to understand a lot more from both sides, to be honest. I would have obviously a bias towards, you know, my dad's
understandable
history and his involvement. So that's just me being honest. But I've always been educated on both sides in terms of, I think that was a crucial part that my dad educated me on. And as I said, the crucial part for him was, like, it was the one-liner that always stuck with me. It shouldn't have happened. None of it should have happened. And today, you could give numerous examples of atrocities on both sides and across the water as well. And down here, in terms of Dublin and Monaghan bombings and stuff like that, you know, it doesn't progress where we should be in terms of peace, you know. And that was the crucial part from my dad. Like, if I came to my dad tomorrow and said, I want to join the Provisional IRA, he'd be the first one to say, you know, not a chance, you know, from what happened and what went on. He would have had to live with some of the things he did, and that certainly impacted his mental health and his physical health. And I'm sure the victims of the Troubles likewise, and you have to be very respectful of all aspects and stakeholders of what happened. But I'll go back to that line: none of it should have happened. Diversity should be a power, not a weakness in this island. And I think that's going to be very, very important over the next couple of years when we talk about the possible change that this country might go through. I think there's complexities. It's very difficult to get to a stage where we would be on both sides of the fence, that you're you know, everything is equal. But at the end of the day, we shouldn't be bound by history, but we should learn from history and take that forward into making everybody as equal as possible going forward.
Including people from the unionist community. If ultimately we become a united Ireland, they become citizens of this country and should be equal to everybody else.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's, as I said, there's so many topics that need to be trashed out and discussed, and people up the north would certainly feel like there's possibly a disconnection down south and a neglect possibly as well, you know. And I think that can also be looked at with an interest, you know, because look, whether it be political agenda, whether it be propaganda over the years in terms of the political parties that were in power versus, let's say, Republican populism in terms of Sinn Féin. I think it's crucial that we disconnect from that and realise that, like, we can learn so much from the past and take this country into the future and be a special place for everybody.
Finally, if you had grown up in Belfast, how many All-Ireland medals would you have won with Antrim?
I've always stated that if I ever was to work with a team outside of Dublin, it'd be Antrim. So how many All-Irelands would I have won? Who knows? But Antrim is a special place to me. Lennadoon in Belfast, West Belfast is a special place to me, and I'll never forget my roots up there. You know, as much as I love my roots at Dublin and Ballymun, Antrim is a special place for me, and who knows, one day I might get a chance to help them out, do something in terms of sport.
What's your family's view on you telling your father's story? Are they happy about it, or are they sensitive? You know, people can be sensitive about talking about personal issues. You're very open talking about yourself and your family.
I'm only open, I have to disclose, I'm only open because my dad is no longer living here, and there's no harm can be done to him in terms of possibly being arrested, let's say, in terms of being on the run. But I only speak about my dad because I'm proud of him. I really am. As I said over and over again, I'm a proud son of somebody that fought for his community, beliefs and purpose. You could say his country as well, you know, to an extent. But for me, you know, I'm very proud of him. And my family, especially my mum, she's okay with me speaking about him because she feels the same way. It is very sensitive, I would imagine, for his family up the north. There is more Republicans coming out with books and other things and talking about their situations and their experiences. But once you're not harming anybody in terms of what you do from both sides, which I probably will, but because of, you know, my feeling towards him and what he did. But look, I think it's important that this information is out there to help move forward and to not forget also, and to be proud of certain things and possibly not other things. But for me, I've no problem saying that I'm proud son of a West Belfast man who shot in the stomach when he was 16, escaped from a British prison and fought for his community and his nationalist community and the people of Lennadoon.
Does that help with the reconciliation process?
When you're telling stories on both sides of, you know, obviously we're not probably hearing the other stories down here as much from a unionist and loyalist background, but the reason why I think it helps is that, you know, you can always stem it back to a why. Why did it happen? You know, we can say we didn't, it shouldn't have happened, but you can always say why. And you can't understand the why unless you tell a story about it. Crucially, my dad had a purpose in life. His piece was around the nationalist community, Frisian IRA. Mine is Ballymun, and challenging maybe neglect from political neglect or other kind of social inequalities that the community has had. So that's passed into me. That's the story I want to tell. You know, I'm not on here to boast about the actions of, you know, the Provisional IRA. I've never once said I'm happy that they done this bombing or this killing or this raid or whatever it may be. I haven't said that once publicly. But the purpose behind it, the why behind it, you know, that protection piece of that community is where I'll always bring it to. And as I said, the lessons that passes down into me because of that, I hope to learn more about the other side of the story and the other side of the wall. I hope to learn more about that. But I'm very open and curious to it.
And my thanks to Philly McMahon. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Mary Carroll and Garrett Mulhall, researched by Dave Hanratty, with sound design by John Smith. And if you've been affected by any of the topics in this podcast, just search the Irish Independent for someone to talk to. It is back to normal business tomorrow on the Indo Daily. Don't forget to like, follow, and leave us a review.